So thank you very much for the kind invitation, Dougal. So I'm going to speak about early diagnosis of cancer, echoing some of the themes that Harpal and Billy have touched upon, which is the fate of the person going third. But then I'm going to focus a little bit more on the opportunity to use genetics and genomics to target our precision prevention and screening. So echoing what Harpal said, the majority of patients present with advanced disease, and patients presenting with advanced disease largely die of their cancer. In addition, there are very high treatment costs around investigations, around very expensive drugs, and around prolonged inpatient stays. We've heard a lot about clever drugs, targeted drugs that have been developed to treat cancer, but these are almost invariably used in the advanced setting. That means these drugs do not cure patients. They typically extend their lives, and often that will only be for a matter of a few months. And these drugs have very, very high development costs, which are now in the excess of $1 billion to bring a drug to market. And therefore, commensurate with that, there are very high per patient costs in administering these drugs that only buy a few months, which can be in excess of £10,000 per treatment round. So tumours are not homogenous. Tumours are clonal. They are made up of subclones of cells which have different molecular characteristics. So that targetable mutation that you're using your expensive drug to treat may only be present in a subset of the cells of the cancer. And then the cancer is ruthlessly Darwinian. You throw a drug at it, you create a selective pressure, you drive development of resistance mutations. The resistant clone has a selective advantage, and lo and behold, that clone expands, predominates, and the tumour continues to progress. And there's been lots of mathematical modelling of cancer, and a lot of those data suggest that what might happen is there is a catastrophic molecular event at some point in cancer development, and after that there is aggressive, unbridled replication of the tumour, whereby the normal mechanisms of defence of the cell become increasingly futile. So this then gets back to, as Harpal said and as Billy echoed, it has remained the case for hundreds of years, therefore, that the way that we cure cancer is through surgery. And the way that we deliver effective surgery that can cure the cancer is getting to that tumour when it is small enough, localised enough, and before it has bolted with its catastrophic molecular event. So, on a population level, therefore, if we shift the point of average diagnosis, we increase the number of tumours that we can treat effectively and successfully with our surgery. So we've been talking about early detection, but actually coupled very closely and even better than early detection is prevention, and often those two will go hand in hand, and particularly when I'm talking a little bit about the potential of genetics. So just a few themes that we will think about in terms of early detection and prevention. What do we need? We need effective screening programs. Harpal's talked about this. We are way behind the curve with certain of our screening programs, particularly bowel cancer screening. We are behind most of the rest of Europe using FOB testing rather than FIT testing, and our delivery of bowel scope, i.e. everyone should have a flexi sig at age 55, we are totally under-providing because of our capacity in endoscopy. So we could do that a lot better. We need public education around screening uptake. Again, as Harpal and Billy said, the uptake of bowel screening is around about 50%. We could do a lot better with that. We need education around public health interventions and lifestyle change, a very small curve shift around obesity, around smoking, and around those other public health indices has quite a substantial impact on cancer incidence. We need to expand our vaccine programs. HPV vaccination saves lives, but we only give it to girls. It can also prevent, as well as cervical cancer, other HPV-driven cancers, for example, anal cancer or head and neck cancers. We should be vaccinating young boys as well. We are not doing that, and that is another missed opportunity. And then the fifth element of this is chemo prevention. There are drugs that cost pennies that reduce the incidence of cancer, that aspirin, statins, metformin. We are not using these drugs systematically. That is another missed opportunity wrapped up in this prevention and early diagnosis package. So logically, when we're thinking about screening and prevention, we target the populations that are most likely to have the cancer in question. At the moment, the two things that we use are age and gender. So we target our three screening programmes accordingly based on the age and gender at which we're most likely to pick up the cancer. However, I put to you the question, can we use other factors to better target our screening programmes? Can we use genetics and can we use other non-genetic factors in order to get more bang for our buck in the subpopulations in whom we deliver our screening and preventative measures? For any type of cancer, it is true to say that the majority of cancers will arise in the minority of people who are genetically susceptible to that cancer. So this is a receiver-operator curve, and you could draw one of these for any type of cancer. This is one that my postdoc drew for testicular cancer, which is one of the tumour types I study. So this blue curve here shows the relationship between the proportion of patients at genetic risk and the percentage of cancers detected. So if you see, it's not very bold here, but a line at 20%, if you take those, the quintile of men at the top 20% genetic risk of testicular cancer, 87% of the cases of cancer will arise in that quintile. So I think those types of data are quite compelling when we think about using our resources for screening and prevention in a focused and targeted fashion. So we have known about genetic susceptibility to cancer since, it seems, Roman times, when there's been documentation of familial clustering of breast cancer. This chap is Dr. Warfin, who in 1913 wrote a paper in Archives of Internal Medicine detailing the family of his seamstress, in which he observed a marked excess of cancers of the gastrointestinal tract and of the gynecological tract. However, he foolishly didn't put his name to it, so along in 1966 came Professor Henry Lynch, who documented a couple more such families and gave his name to the now eponymous Lynch syndrome. In the 1990s, four genes underpinning Lynch syndrome were identified, and the biological mechanism causing this syndrome of cancer susceptibility was identified to be defects in basic scission repair pathways. And studying individuals and families carrying mutations in these genes has shown that they have a lifetime risk of 70 to 80% of developing cancer. And these cancers develop young. Look, you can see the curves pulling up at age 30, and by 40, they have a substantial accrued incidence of cancer. So this is a typical Lynch syndrome pedigree. We've got two cases of colorectal cancer. They've died young, a brain tumor, an ovarian cancer who's died young, another colorectal cancer up here, and an endometrial cancer. And until recently, the patient who would come to my genetics clinic would be this woman. She would come along concerned that her sister had recently been diagnosed with bowel cancer at a young age and that she had this dreadful family history of cancer. And what would I do? Well, I'd jot a letter to the surgeon looking after the sister saying, do you think you should refer her to the genetics clinic? He would duly do so. The genetic service reviewing the sister, they would look at the family history and go, I think she's just about earned herself a genetic test. And we'd be able to identify the causative mutation in her. They'd write back to me, I can test my patient for it, and institute measures to address her high risk of cancer. But in order to get to this point, all these other people have had to die of cancer before we were able to ascertain the family. So if we do a sort of thought time travel experiment, how about if this chap here, having been diagnosed with colorectal cancer, he doesn't have to earn his genetic test by having loads and loads of relatives die of cancer. He could just have his genetic test because he's had colorectal cancer. That would be really good because we could ascertain the mutation in him. And that means that we could change the course of the history of this family. So look, everyone has their genetic test as they reach early adulthood, and they know if they're at high risk of cancer or if they're off the hook. Wouldn't that be great? And that would mean that these two women, rather than getting their endometrial cancer and ovarian cancers and dying young, they could, when they've finished having their family, they have risk-reducing hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. That means removal of the ovaries, the tubes, and the uterus, the organs we know to be at risk. And then they can live long, rich lives that are cancer-free. These two women, rather than getting colorectal cancer young, They can have colonoscopy regularly, which is what we do for Lynch carriers. Rather than developing bowel cancer, we pick up their polyps. Again, they lead long, full, cancer-free lives, and so forth. My patient could come along knowing that she carries the causative mutation. We can offer pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. That means she can have IVF, embryo selection, and ensure that her child does not go on to develop any types of cancer because they don't carry the mutation. So historically, genetic testing wasn't very good. It was manual, it was low throughput, it was slow, and it was pretty insensitive. And it essentially involved generating these electrophoresis gels, holding up to the window and trying to figure out if it was a mutation or not. However, in the last decade, we've seen an absolute renaissance in our sequencing technology. And this is called next generation sequencing, and has absolutely been a game changer in terms of what we can do in terms of identifying mutations in these patients. Sequencing is now cheap as chips, high throughput, very quick, and very sensitive. And that means we can really, really think about expanding the populations and patients that we offer genetic testing to. And I hope I've convinced you that knowing about Lynch syndrome mutations is really useful for early detection and prevention of cancer. We can give them regular colonoscopy from age 25, pick up these cancers before they occur, while there are still polyps. We can give them preventative surgery. So as I said, taking out the womb and the ovaries before they develop cancer. We don't tend to do prophylactic colectomies, but if a patient develops a bowel cancer or a nasty polyp, we can remove the major part of the bowel at risk so they don't go on to develop metachronous colorectal cancers. And aspirin is really effective in these patients. It reduces the incidence of bowel cancer very substantially. And we have a dosing study underway, CAP3, led by Professor Sir John Byrne. There's some interesting work in immunomodulating drugs, which are likely to be effective in terms of chemo prevention and reducing cancer in these patients. And this is probably the population in whom we're going to see the first successful cancer vaccine because of the molecular biology of the way in which these tumours arise. And again, some research around screening programmes in endometrial and ovarian screening. So another paradigm, hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, as made sort of widely known by Angelina Jolie and her family history. Again, much the same story. Catastrophic incidence of breast cancer, early ovarian cancer and prostate cancer. Again, this sister with ovarian cancer typically would be what brought the family to medical attention. So we do the test in her, we find the BRCA mutation. But if we tested all cases of breast cancer, again, the same story. We ascertain the mutation early on, we change the natural history of the cancer pattern in the family. So we find the mutations, and rather than dying of ovarian cancer, these women can have preventative surgery. Rather than developing fatal breast cancer, this woman has early screening with MRI mammography. And then this woman can have a prophylactic mastectomy, so she doesn't even develop her breast cancer. So again, the same story. Genetics is power. It gives us knowledge. It allows us to intervene before the cancer happens or to catch it much earlier. So again, many options, very useful ascertaining individuals who carry mutations in BRCA1 and BRCA2. We can do the screening and early detection. We can do the preventative surgery. Again, we have chemoprophylaxis. 5 years of tamoxifen reduces the incidence of breast cancer in these women by 30%. It is, however, not a nice drug to take, so there is a lot of research in this area, some promising work around RANK ligand inhibitors for chemoprophylaxis, and these are under trial in the States. So I hope you can see the power of using genetics, not just for early detection and prevention in your patient, but for giving information to their immediate relatives, for giving reproductive options in terms of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, but also, and I haven't touched upon this, if the patient does develop cancer, knowing the underlying genetic cause in that patient allows us to manage the cancer using precision oncology, using chemotherapeutic agents that are targeted to that genetic cause, using special agents that work and subvert that molecular mechanism and give good information about prognosis. So I'm just going to talk a little bit more broadly now. And when we think about the totality of genetic factors that underpin a particular cancer, we've talked about these ones up here. So this is a schematic with effect size on the y-axis and frequency of the genetic factor on the x-axis. So the ones I've talked about, mutations in BRCA1 and the Lynch genes, are necessarily pretty low frequency in the population because they have such a high effect size. But for any cancer, there is this spectrum of different types of genetic factors going down here to genetic factors which just confer an additional little bit of risk of cancer, but of which, for any given tumour type, there are hundreds, if not thousands, associated with that type of cancer. So if we look at breast cancer, as we've talked about, there's BRCA1 and BRCA2, high effect, pretty low frequency in the population. There are some other high penetrance genes that I see individuals in my genetics clinic with mutations in these genes. But there are 94 common variants published for breast cancer, each of which confer a bit of risk of breast cancer, and we all carry a burden of them. So I may have 37 of these, you may have 55, you may have 67. We all carry a burden of these common susceptibility variants. So can those be used clinically to help us identify individuals at higher risk? Well, yes, and there's some work in that space at the moment. So this is a schematic provided by Doug Easton in Cambridge. So we're back to our receiver-operator curve. So on the x-axis, the population lined up by risk. On the y-axis, the number of cases. So the blue line shows what happens if you use non-genetic factors to try and identify women at risk of breast cancer. So non-genetic factors include family history, body mass index, age at first period, number of children, breastfeeding, and so forth. If you use a package of those factors, it's reasonably predictive. The 94 common variants I talked about, that's shown with the red line. If you combine the non-genetic factors and the 94 variants, you get the yellow line. And if you throw in breast density on first mammogram and use a sort of tripartite risk model, that gives you the top line here, the green line. And then if we draw the line here, we can see from, you've got a line here, you've got your third of women using this model in the highest tertile of risk, the highest third, contains two-thirds of the cases of breast cancer. So again, given that this is such a common disease, using this model, we can potentially focus our screening better. So showing this differently, you can divide the population into quintiles of risk, so five groups according to their risk from that three-part model. And along here is a line. This is absolute risk of breast cancer. And this line is important because this is an absolute risk of 2.5% per 10 years. And 2.5% per 10 years is the average risk of breast cancer in the total population of women having screening between age 47 and age 70. Their average risk is that risk on the line. And you can see your risk goes up with age, but these two bottom quintiles of risk using our model never even hit that average risk, even when they're at their age of highest breast cancer risk. So what would this look like if, rather than giving breast screening based purely on age alone, which is what we do at the moment, we offer breast screening to all women aged 47 to 70, what would it look like if we used our tripartite model, the non-genetic factors, those 94 risk variants, and breast density to target women who are at genuine elevated risk of breast cancer? So this is a hypothetical population of women aged 35 to 80. The women in green, the little green bodies, which aren't well projected, but these are women under 47. The red bodies are women over 47. The ones with the yellow background are in the lower risk category. The ones with a blue background are in the higher risk category. So this is your hypothetical population. These are the ones that we offer screening to at the moment. So only the ones with the little red bodies, because only the over 47s get screening at the moment. But if we offered screening based on the individuals being at high risk by our model, we would just screen these ones. So actually going from here to here, you reduce the number of women being screened by 31%. So what's your cost? Well, this is the breast cancer cases arising in the population. These are the ones that you pick up with your current screening model. And these are the ones that you pick up if you screen based on risk using our risk model. So these ones using age alone, these ones forgetting about age but using our current risk model. So you can save 31% of your mammograms and only drop your breast cancer detection by 2%. And what you can do with that resource that you saved
is potentially offer more screening to those who are at really high risk. You could screen them more often rather than doing it every 3 years, do it every 1 year. You could throw in MRI as an additional modality. So really target your screening at the women who are at highest risk.
So I'm going to stop there because I think I'm just hitting time. So I hope I've in some way helped communicate that genetics is a good way to target resources in terms of early detection and prevention. I think it's helpful to think of those two together. The majority of cancers occur in the minority of the population who are genetically predisposed. It is really useful to ascertain that modest number of individuals who carry these high-risk mutations, because they are at very high risk of cancer, and we know how to intervene with those in terms of early detection, but also prevention using some simple measures like aspirin. However, we can do risk modelling combining non-genetic factors with genetic factors and apply that to the totality of the population who otherwise would be presenting for screening and perhaps use our resource for screening more effectively. And we are all on the same page because, echoing what Harpal and Billy said, colorectal cancer, if we wanted to start somewhere, would be a really good place in which we could target our early detection and prevention. Aspirin is really effective, and the tools that we have at the moment for screening are pretty good if we rolled them out properly and improved uptake. And actually, with good good programs in screening and early detection, there's probably no reason why anyone needs to die of bowel cancer. And I think that's an area where we could really get sort of tractable progress. So Dougal asked me to leave a few questions. These are probably more specifically around the genetics element. One issue about targeting your screening, is it palatable to take away the breast screening program from those in the lower tertile of risk? And that may be controversial. It's very useful to collect, compile registries of individuals at increased genetic risk. This allows us to manage them more effectively, to learn which interventions are effective in those populations. But this involves holding data on people. And the best way of doing this would be using Section 251, where we can link them and we don't have to get embroiled in specific consents. So I think that is worth consideration. And this broader question, we need to fund these really long-term, large-scale genetic cohort studies and large-scale screening implementation studies, echoing what Billy was saying. These things are not cheap. They are long-term, but they offer progressive gain if we invest in them properly. So thank you very much for listening.